Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Elizabeth Austin, Amara Enya, Jennifer Nevins, and Brian Westbury. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to send a tweet, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web audio and video each and every week, or even in between our broadcasts. And you can see and watch the shows at beyondthebeltway.com. Tonight is historic. It is the first Sunday night beyond the Beltway of the Trump administration, and we have much to talk about. A lot has happened since we last met, and a lot has happened just in the last 48 hours, 72 hours. And I'd like to begin because we have a couple of newcomers on the program this evening and some veterans as well. And I want to begin with Jennifer Nevins, who is our card-carrying Trump supporter. You were for Donald Trump in the primary, so you were not a Jennifer come lately on the Trump train. But of the things in the last 72 hours that have happened in America, what's the most significant to you?
The most significant is that there is going to be a continued resistance to Donald Trump and his administration. It's not going to end. Things are not all kumbaya after this inauguration. We didn't expect them to be, but I think the level of rancor, rhetoric, and property destruction, quite frankly, has proven to anybody that had any doubt that this is going to be an uphill battle, an uphill climb, that we're going to have to fight for every inch of territory that we get.
Amara Enya, what was the most important thing in your life politically over the last 72 hours, as far as the country is concerned?
Well, I mean, the inauguration is the biggest thing that happened. I do think I'm actually not surprised at the reaction. I do think it is going to be an uphill battle for the Trump administration as far as trying to have some semblance of legitimacy in the face of a lot of protests and a lot of people who, quite frankly, feel that he doesn't represent their interests. So this is where we are. The inauguration has happened. This is the person that is leading the country. And so we have to see where it goes.
Brian Westbury, what was the high point of the last 72 hours for you?
Yeah, it was the address, the inauguration.
Chief economist,
address.
By the way, a first trust here in Chicago.
That's right. It was an amazing inauguration address. America first. It reminded me a lot of Ronald Reagan, a huge change in the direction of the country. And a lot of people are having a difficult time understanding what that means. Mm-hmm. So
I was watching, just my own personal assessment, I was watching with a close friend who is a Republican. And when the speech began, we looked at each other at least three or four times and said, wow, where's he going? Where's he going with this? And it reminded me, because I covered the Harold Washington campaign in Chicago, it reminded me a great deal of Harold Washington, the first African-American mayor in Chicago back in 1983. And in his inaugural address, surrounded by all the power elites, including the former mayor, he basically excoriated the sort of the right. Corrupt feeling of the Chicago mm-hmm. City Council, and literally he laid down the gauntlet that day. I mean, he from day one, he was a pugilist. He was going to go in there and he was going to fight for his people, and that's what Trump did last Friday reminded me a great deal of Harold Washington. Elizabeth Austin, rather, thanks very much for being with us. Maiden voyage here this evening, a public policy student at the Harris School of University of Chicago and a communications strategic planner. What was your reaction and the most important event of the last 72 hours?
Actually, I'm going to disagree. I understand the importance of the inauguration, but we have an inauguration every 4 years. And I think the thing that was most important that happened over the last 72 hours was that 4 million people in the United States in more than 500 cities and towns and villages across the nation on a single day stood up to make their voices heard. And that is the largest, I believe, demonstration nationwide in the history of our country.
And what would you like to see happen next? By the way, I would acknowledge that I would put the inauguration and the demonstrations yesterday almost on an even par, because no president has had this sort of organized resistance from day one. And we'll discuss whether these are viable reasons to be upset. But where does it go next?
I think that's an important question, and I think it's one that we can't answer today. I think it remains to be seen how the people, mostly women, who were involved in the demonstrations choose to proceed going forward. It is my hope that they will become more involved politically and that they will understand that the important thing that we have to do is become involved on a local, a regional, and a statewide basis so that we are prepared in 4 years.
Amara, let me ask you, where were those 4 million people on Election Day? And where was that level of enthusiasm on Election Day for Hillary Clinton? I mean, almost 29, 30 million people voted for Donald Trump, women voted for Donald Trump. But not enough women voted for her and these issues that were discussed in the streets yesterday in November.
Well, that's quite true. I think so. There needs to be, I think, parsing out a subsection of that 4 million people. So there are people who have been organizing around the issues for ages, particularly people of color, who Trump represents a lot of the things when we talk about law and order, you talk about just some of the rhetoric. He represents a lot of things that people have been organizing around for decades from the beginning. A lot of people who came out for these marches most recently had not been politically engaged before. So this is sort of new to them, whereas there have been people who've been on the ground doing this work for eons without having that massive support. Now, statistically speaking, black women voted for Hillary Clinton 94%. And this is for a lot of black women, it was done with hesitation. She was not the top choice, but they did it because they knew that it was either her or Trump. White women voted for Hillary Clinton to the tune of 53%, and I don't think that we've unpacked what that exactly means. I don't think that conversation, that critical conversation about what it means to not stand in solidarity with a Hillary Clinton means.
Jennifer, I want to get your reaction. 29, 30 million women voted for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. You were one of those. You know a lot of people who did that. Mm-hmm. What is it that Donald Trump could do or should do to try to address and maybe tone down the opposition? Or should he spend any time at all doing it?
See, this is, I think, a fundamental problem that we're having, because when I was watching some of the coverage of the Women's March this morning, three issues kept coming up and up. One of them was maternity leave. People upset because they wanted maternity leave coverage that they didn't have now. This idea of the Lilly Ledbetter Act, equal pay, and LGBTQ equality. And what I would say to that is, on the first two, equal pay and maternity leave, if you've got a problem with that, that doesn't have anything to do with Trump. I mean, Barack Obama was in office for 8 years. Before that, someone else was in before that.
Democrats and on, were
absolutely.
And
excuse
controls.
Me,
absolutely.
Hold
on 1 second, and I'll be done. On those three issues, what's interesting is Trump espouses a more, I don't want to say liberal, but a more open view on those issues than anybody else that was on the stage for the Republican nomination. So I find it curious that they're so upset when he has actually spoken out in favor of maternity leave very strongly, even at the convention.
Elizabeth, you've got a point. We do have to break. When we come back, you will have the microphone, but right now we're going to pause. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school.
Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone.
I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Elizabeth, you were going to make a point with when Jennifer was chatting.
I just wanted to point out that to the best of my recollection, President Obama did in fact sign the Lilly Ledbetter Act. And I believe that the concern is that that may not be that it may not continue under a new administration, especially with this Congress. I also would point out that, you know, certainly when we talk about things like child care, which is a crucial issue for so many women, I was a working mom. You know, it was the biggest expense I had. And I think that we need to remember that the Trump administration has not yet shown a sensitivity to the lives of working American women. The idea that you would have a child care deduction, you know, there's a large number of women in dire need of child care who may never have an income that a deduction makes a difference. The people who need the most help are the ones who either have no income, who are students, or who are very low income, who are trying to rise to the middle class. They need a lot more help than the people like me who can deduct.
Would you acknowledge, though, that at least during the campaign, Ivanka Trump talked not only at the convention, but also made a couple of speeches, significant, got a lot of publicity for one, I believe, given in Philadelphia, where she talked about the agenda, the Trump agenda for women. And as a working mom, that this was going to be her pet topic. And coincidentally, she was always going to have the ear of the President of the United States. Do you have any confidence that what she was talking about is something that she believes in and would really like to see policy of the country?
Only God can see in our hearts, so I am in no position to judge Ivanka Trump's heart. Mm-hmm. However, I will say that the way that she was talking about these issues and the solutions that she was putting forth did not seem to show any understanding of the real concerns for women who are facing poverty, who are trying to bring up children with, you know, not enough resources, and who are not getting the support of society that I think they require.
Brian.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we can't see in anybody's heart, but what we do know about economics is that when you provide government solutions, when you redistribute wealth, you actually hurt economic growth, which then in the long run actually hurts the very people that are asking for the help. So we know that a smaller government and a bigger private sector provides for more wealth gains, for more income, for more people, and more opportunity and more decision making. And so one of the things that I hear you saying, Elizabeth, if you can't see in her heart, that if what I think I hear is that she's not providing a purely government solution, and therefore you can't believe in it. And one of the things about free market economics is that you have to have faith in it. You have to believe that it provides. And if you look at the United States, we started as a backwater colony and we're the world's richest country. And the reason is not because of government, it's because of the free market. And so the further we get away from a free market, the less wealth we have and the more problems people have. And I think that's why Donald Trump won, because he spoke to all those people who were being asked to pay for all the things that a lot of people that supported President Obama were asking for.
Mm-hmm. And I think Elizabeth just spoke to something interesting. And you mentioned that we can't see inside Donald Trump's heart, but there is no willingness at all to give any benefit of the doubt here. I was at the convention, and I sat there as Donald Trump and Ivanka both mentioned paid or government partially subsidized leave for maternity. And that's something that a lot of conservatives were clutching their pearls over. Oh, my gosh, what's he saying? Because it was such a departure from traditional conservative doxology. So I think that, or ideology, rather. So I think that that is something that I'm sitting here scratching my head saying they're so upset about that. They don't have it now, and they're upset that Trump is not going to give it to them, and they're upset that he may roll back some provisions of the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which he has not in any case indicated that he was going to do. So I think a lot of this fear is just that. It's unfounded fear.
Mara.
I will say that from the campaign, during the campaign season, I thought that the commercial that Ivanka Trump did was actually the strongest commercial of Donald Trump's entire campaign because she focused on her role as a woman, as a mother, as a working mother. So I thought that was a strong suit for them. But I do want to separate the notion of smaller government from the fundamental need for access to child care for families, which in fact helps women to work and contribute to their families. So it's not a question of whether or not government should be smaller. This is a question of how do we make sure that women who are oftentimes providers or are bringing in income to the home have an opportunity to have access to child care, which will allow them to work and contribute to the economy.
I would like, well, go ahead, Elizabeth.
I mean, I would point out that, you know, I, as you mentioned, I study at the University of Chicago, where there is an emphasis on math. And so when we hear Donald Trump saying on one hand that he wants to provide paid leave, at least partially government subsidized, and on the other hand, he wants to cut taxes and cut $1 trillion from the federal budget, these things don't add up.
When he makes a promise, by the way, any politician who wins election, I think on the very next day, they figure out, how can I get more people to support me when I run for reelection? So he's looking at the 4 million people that were out on the street yesterday. Mm-hmm. What can I do or what can I say to them? He wants to hold his base, but how can I get more of those people at least to believe in me and maybe vote for me in 4 years? Is there anything that Donald Trump could do to the masses that were in the street yesterday? Mm-hmm. Is there anything that he could do that would ever get any of them to give him a second chance and say, you know what, maybe he wasn't that bad?
I will tell you what Donald Trump could do to win my vote. And that's a fairly huge statement for anyone who knows me. If Donald Trump led a strong, consistent, successful effort to overturn the voter suppression efforts that we saw in so many states in the recent election, if he would make improving voter turnout, reducing suppression, expanding suffrage his major issue, returning democracy to people for whom it is no longer available, that would make me support him.
I
feel pretty good about that.
Okay, can I ask who doesn't have suffrage, who is 18 or older in this country? Because I am curious when you said that, and who was disenfranchised in this election?
This was the first election since the Voting Rights Act was sort of undermined. On election day, in a number of states that had been affected by, you know, under the control of the Voting Rights Act, there were 868 fewer election polling places in states like Texas, Arizona, North Carolina, in Indiana, which of course Barack Obama won in 2008. There was one early voting place in Marion County, compared with Boone County. Okay, Marion County
is a voting issue, not an issue that necessarily is going to make life better for a woman who is trying to raise kids.
You asked me if there was one issue,
that's the one that is by
my heart.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I looked at the protesters yesterday and the people who didn't vote for Donald Trump. And I think the number one thing you can do is boost economic growth. And I believe that you do that by cutting the size of government, allowing the private sector to be bigger, and cutting tax rates. And if you do that, I think there's going to be more prosperity for all groups. I think he can raise his votes from the Hispanic arena, from the Black arena, and from the women. If economic growth,
Brian,
picks up.
Your area of expertise is obviously jobs and trade. Jobs was obviously the single issue that he kept talking about over and over again, maybe even more so than illegal immigration. What can a president do or say right now? How quickly will we know whether Donald Trump is delivering on his promise to deliver more jobs? What should we be looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes great headlines, 700 jobs for, you know, Carrier and 1,000 jobs in here. That's not what really makes a difference. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of jobs in total, 145 million employed Americans, and we're going to gain 10 to 15 to 20 million jobs in the next 8 years if he's president. But we won't know immediately,
right.
but what we have to do is you have to, as an economist, I look, do we have faith in government to create wealth, or do we have faith in the free market to create wealth? And if you go look at France in the last 40 years, 2% real GDP growth, which we've just had 8 years of, and we hate it, and they've had an 8% unemployment rate. And that's what comes from a big government. So if you have faith in the free market, you will create more jobs and you will see incomes go up faster. And so
if the roads and the bridges and all the infrastructure goes through,
right,
that will be viewed as a government program, right?
Although
it will be hiring non-government people to build those
things. Right, but I don't believe it's the hiring of people to build roads that actually the highway system in America has made us more productive.
Yes.
It allows Walmart and Amazon and everybody to get their goods to customers. It allows us all to have the freedom to get wherever we want, to visit grandmother, grandfather, go on vacation, all of those things. And so that's what the real productivity gains are. Do we have a crumbling infrastructure? Well, that makes it hard. Look at traffic jams in every city in the country.
If there's this huge public works project,
right,
is that viewed, in your view, is that viewed as a government program, or is it viewed as a program where government money is used to hire
government program that's used to hire people to create jobs. And part of me, that's honestly what it is. This is a work program based around infrastructure. I think the one thing that the president can do is it's how he sets the tone for what local and regional economic growth should look like. And so one thing that's been a concern for me is this notion, for example, in the manufacturing sector, that somehow will bring jobs back. And that's actually not the case. The language has to be about how do we create jobs for the future of that sector. So this sense that people are we're going to be able to rely on the coal industry or traditional manufacturing is sending the wrong message.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. There's calls on the line. We will bring them into our conversation when we roll on from Chicago.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much. Let's go to Eve. She is listening to us on Sirius XM radio tonight, and she lives in Detroit. Go ahead, Eve.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good.
I just like to point out the fact that Trump's plan for paid leave that he proposed is only for married women. It doesn't cover unwed mothers, it doesn't cover husbands, and it doesn't cover people who have adopted.
Jennifer, your reaction to that?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that distinction. They certainly didn't make that distinction at the convention. Was that something that they put in writing, or that? Because I'd really like to read up on that.
It's printed on his website.
That it's not for married. It's only for married women, and not for adopted children.
It was clear that it was not for adoptive children, and that it did not cover fathers. And I think that, you know, people don't seem to understand that for maternity leave, it's less about the physical stress of childbirth, although that is real, but it's mostly trying to survive on 2 hours of sleep without, like, running the car into something. And so it's not just the mom who's dealing with that.
What happens if the mother is on bed rest or has postpartum depression and the husband has to then take off work?
Absolutely.
How is the family going to survive if the husband can't work either?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the problem that, you know, very often people I know that have employers that do have paid parental leave, Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the mom takes the first 3 months, the dad takes the second 3 months, and by after 6 months, things are, you know, one hopes that people are sleeping.
Well, I would point out that Trump has been in office for 2 days, and Obama was in office for 8 years, and if the policies that people, certain people want to see enacted weren't enacted, or were not done to someone's satisfaction, that doesn't lie with Trump. And as far as paternity leave never was part of what Trump was saying that he was going to do during
what about
campaign.
Jennifer's point? She's made it a couple. Let me ask a question from Mara, and then I'll give you the last word, Eve. Jennifer's talked a couple of times this evening about some of these issues that people were complaining about yesterday, the women 4 million in the street. Some of these things are things that could have been addressed over the last 8 years.
Yes, I mean, a lot of the frustration that you have seen is, again, as the point that I made earlier, is that there are people who've been out on these issues for even under the Obama administration and pushing for the kind of change that we wanted to see. So for many people, these aren't new issues, but it just, I think that the Trump impetus just makes it that much more urgent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last word to you, Eve, then we're moving on.
Democrats have been pushing these issues. It's Republicans who have been pushing back. So Obama wouldn't have been able to push it through probably regardless because the House wouldn't have let it through. So when Trump stands on a stage and says that he plans on bringing maternity leave with equal rights, it's unfair not to offer it to men.
Well, let me just say that I'm going to make a prediction here. Right now, we're talking about on day 3 of his administration, we're talking about those that protested yesterday, most of whom were out there for progressive causes. I'll put that up, sort of a broad brush on it. I'm going to predict in a year from now, Donald Trump will be having as much trouble with his right base
yes.
as he is with those that didn't vote for him. Because a lot of the things that this guy is not a conservative Republican. He has fewer ideological baggage or strings to him than anyone that's ever been president. And I think he's going to tick off an awful lot of Republicans.
But Pence has those very conservative ties.
Well, then you know what? Here's the point, Eve. Everyone that's out there should be praying every night that Donald Trump lives every single day of his administration. And you shouldn't have stars out there suggesting that she wants to burn down the White House.
Right.
That might hurt the President of the United States. So be thankful for what you have because what may follow may be worse. Do you agree with that, Elizabeth?
Which part?
that if anything happened to Donald Trump, maybe Mike Pence would be less willing to open up these issues because he is more of an ideologue than Donald Trump.
Okay, I disagree with a lot of people on this one because I actually think that if for whatever reason Donald Trump did not complete his term, once Mike Pence becomes president, it becomes a feeding frenzy throughout the Republican Party to position for 2020 because I don't think that Pence has the level of, heaven help us, charisma.
Gravitas.
That Donald, he doesn't have gravitas. He doesn't have charisma. He doesn't have a power base. And I don't know that I've ever heard him speak. I've watched speeches. I've watched debates. But I just have no memory of Mike Pence whatsoever.
Okay, well, so, a lot of your progressive women would Eve, wait, Eve, you got your quarter's worth. We got to go. We're going to go to Robert. Also listening to us on Sirius XM, and he is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Nice to hear from the Music City tonight. Go ahead. We go from one Music City to the other.
Exactly. Love the show. Really thankful for the panels tonight. We've got a good group.
Thank you.
Who's the mathematician on the group? Because here's the question. You have 318 million people in the United States, and what do we estimate in the entire nationwide turnout today or yesterday would have been maybe... What did they hear? 3 million?
4 million.
Probably four.
Yeah, 4 million.
So percentage-wise, what would that be?
I mean, it's about 1%.
Yeah, that's my point. So, I mean, if you looked at it, you could say every 7 Saturdays of the football season, we turn out 100,000 people at all the stadiums around the United States. I mean, I just think that while we appreciate that they're mad, I just don't know that we should put it in context when we talk about it. I guess that's the point I wanted to make. Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
Well, I think it's also the fact that this was, I mean, there hasn't been, we haven't seen this level mm-hmm. of resistance and protest surrounding an inauguration. So I think that gives it extra newsworthiness to be covered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And by the way, the other thing that I want to just mention, because I mentioned I watched the inauguration was going back and forth from channel to channel. Again, I'm watching this with my good friend, and we were saying to ourselves, it doesn't look like there's a lot of people there mm-hmm. based on what we were seeing with our eyes. Now, the stations that we were watching, and we were going back between Fox and CNN and MSNBC, none of the commentators during the inauguration were making any comment at all about the relative, at least the perceived small crowd. Now, later on, when you got into the estimates and you compared the estimates of Friday with the estimates of yesterday, that's where all the, you know, the crowd envy, you know, came into to Donald Trump's mind. But, you know, I was saying that throughout the whole
I thought it was
affair.
Quite evident that the turnout wasn't it wasn't like 2012. It wasn't like 2009. I actually thought it was strange the way that a press conference was held to argue about the numbers from the inauguration. I mean, it seems to be such a distraction and an unnecessary point of conversation, especially when it's accompanied by a blatant lie, to then make the statement that, well, this was the largest inauguration turnout ever, or some kind of superlative that was used, to me just undermined the credibility and made it look even more silly that we're spending time talking about
it. I'd like to speak to that directly and just run just a few of my own numbers real quick by this. 250 arrests, 7 cops injured, several ball attendees injured, Larry King's SUV windows broken through, destroyed destroyed windows en route to events, 5 cars set ablaze. So when you wonder, they estimated there was about 700,000 people at, the National Park Service said there was about 700,000 people at the event. It wasn't nearly as many as Barack Obama had at his event. My husband attended that, so I know of where I speak. It's a little bit intimidating when you know that there are going to be mass protests, and there were mass protests there, and it was broadcast ahead of time that this was going to happen. It's not a place you bring your family. It's not something
that's
that you
exactly
want to just come on down and see.
Yes. But maybe
so I think, I think that that's an important point to make, that you don't just want to go down and see the inauguration if you think that you're going to come to bodily harm or there's going to be a nasty confrontation.
That might be a legitimate point, but that's a point that Spicer could have made and said, hey, this was could have been a safety concern as opposed to using hyperbole.
Did Spicer make a mistake today, Brian, you think?
Oh, I don't know if he made a mistake or not, but I'd make a different point, and that is, we did have 4 million people out, and I'm not sure if it's the world record for protests, but here's the way I look. The government has become so big that if you lose, then you lose, right? So, and if you want to cut the size of government, mm-hmm. you have to fight even harder. So it has become, government has gotten into every nook and cranny of our life, everything we say, even things that we think, things that we tweet, mm-hmm. things that you talk about with other people. And then what happens is that those people who think this growth in government has protected them and helped them want to fight mm-hmm. like crazy when they lose it. And in order to get rid of it, if you think it's wrong, you have to fight like crazy to get rid of it. And so that's why this election was so divisive, and I think why this presidency is going to continue to be divisive. Because
right.
if he really does cut the size of government, there are half the people in America believe that that's the wrong thing to do,
yeah.
and half the people believe it's the right thing to do.
And the people who live in media centers mm-hmm. are those that are most likely
right.
to
right.
want the government programs, and that's why we saw the
right.
largest
right.
demonstrations in those cities, although
right.
we did see them in other cities as well.
Two
Elizabeth.
Points. First of all, I think that Mr. Spicer would have been well advised to take a page from your book and say the reason that Barack Obama gathered all of these people from Washington, D.C. to his inauguration is because that those people were, you know, hopeful that there would be an expansion of government. He could have made it a virtue instead of going into some sort of alternative fact land.
Well, the one thing I said a couple of weeks ago when Sean Spicer made his first Sunday appearance, I think he was on with Chris Wallace, I said, in my view, I thought this guy was going to be terrific.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I said that is he wasn't going to take any premise of any of the Sunday morning moderators. He was going to challenge them on every single point. And that's what he said and did yesterday. I think he went overboard yesterday. But you saw Kelly Conway today. Kellyanne Conway was on the shows today. Rance Priebus was on the shows today. The common denominator is the new spokesman for the Trump administration. They're not going to take any crap from anybody in the media.
Including reality. They're not taking crap from us.
Certainly.
And I...
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through February, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Still back in Chicago. Let's go to Kim listening to us on WCGO from Chicago. Go ahead, Kim.
Yes, hi. Just two quick points about hypocrisy and double standards in the media. The first, quickly, is that all the liberals who refuse to perform at Trump's inaugural would be the first ones to insist that the baker make the cake for the gay wedding. And the second point, more importantly, is on Monday there is a hearing in Chicago for a special prosecutor to hear the case for Obama and the murder of Don Young.
Yeah, okay. Kim, we're going to move on. Kim, you bring this subject up when you're on. You take it into a tangent that is just beyond common sense. So we're not going to go there, okay? It just, you know, speak to things that are relevant and leave the things that are in the woodwork, because that's exactly where much of them belong, okay? Let's go to El Paso, Texas. Jorge or George. You brought George or Jorge in KTSM?
Jorge. Yeah, it's Jorge. Bruce, I'm glad Ken really had nothing relevant to say, because otherwise I wouldn't have something relevant to say here. I think that the opinion that of some of your guests that the reason so many people came out yesterday was because they were protesting the inauguration of President Trump,
yep.
It's just wrong. So many people came out yesterday because of the way that they have dealt for so many years, segregation that so many people have placed against women. Then now the new administration has come in, they have an opportunity to come out and be heard and be seen. And I think it was misfortunate that Madonna, she wanted to reference the White House, the historical house of the nation, in the way that she did.
It's terrible. All right, let me ask you this question, though.
Okay.
What was this brings to the uniqueness of yesterday and the semi-uniqueness of the campaign.
All right.
Hillary Clinton got about 2.8 million more votes than Donald Trump. Now, Everyone knew what the rules were, the Electoral College, that he's the president of the United States.
Right.
To my view, case closed. Let's not waste a lot of time talking about it. But
the
reality is 2.8 million people feel that they're not part of the big win. They're not really excited about Donald Trump because they voted against him, even though they were beyond the Electoral College, you know, the core that selects who the president was. So I can see why they may be upset that, in their view, their voice was not heard. Their voice was not counted by the Electoral College.
Yeah.
And so they are frustrated. And they
And
granted, the issues that were discussed yesterday, in my view, it was a rehash of the issues that we heard in the campaign that were rejected by at least the voters that voted in the Electoral College states.
Okay.
And so I understand why they're frustrated. And I don't have any question. And by the way, I think we want to separate the 4 million protesters from yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
We do have to separate those from the number of people who call themselves protesters. They are really anarchists that were doing all the things, the violence that Jennifer referenced. Entirely different group of people, I believe.
Okay. Okay, well, Bruce, I had your answer for you 2 seconds into your question. You know, the whole idea that so many people's votes went for Hillary Clinton, they didn't go for Trump, that is so irrelevant because, in fact, the second part of the answer to your question is that the Electoral College covers these people as well, and it's because they are covered by way of the electoral vote that we are one union. And in spite of all the differences that some people might have had with Trump, that didn't allow for them to vote for him, that is cause right. enough for them to resist his presidency because the electoral vote said otherwise. That is just wrong because it's right. our American form of constitutional government. It's the one that is reliable and the one that's worked for so many years.
It has, but it also thrives because of free speech and mm-hmm. demonstrations and protests. And if you don't like the current White House, you organize against it. I mean, what we saw on last November with the Trump phenomenon was we saw people that were sitting in there in their view for the last 8 or 16 or 24 years, they've been punching bags. They've been punching bags by the political opposition. They said enough is enough. They rose up and they threw the rascals out. And the president reinforced in that opening speech with some of the rascals within earshot. Mm-hmm. Things are going to change, and we will see what happens. Let me just go ahead, Jorge, quickly.
Fortunately for us, the amendment to the Constitution that is our Bill of Rights took effect immediately upon the ratification of the Constitution. It's for that reason that we have that freedom that allows us to express the way we have. Yesterday, and we'll continue doing it days ahead.
Okay. And by the way, what I want to say is that's one of the things that we try to do here on Beyond the Bell. We have for 37 years. I think maybe the next 4 years are going to be a test of that, because it seems to me that we do have a divided country. We have a divided country, but for a variety of reasons. And when you have that, there has to be discussion. There has to be a level of respect. There has to be a level of civility. I hope we can have that here every Sunday night on Beyond the Bellway. That is my goal. And by the way, the other thing I will say, and I would have said this no matter who won the election, let's take our eyes off the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. Let's not keep replaying. And by the way, I have been guilty of this, but I'm not going to rub it in your face on Sunday night. We know. Politically astute people know that Hillary Clinton lost this election. Donald Trump won it, but Hillary Clinton lost it. We can look in the rearview mirror. We can find all the reasons why he is the president and she is not. But I don't think for the next 4 years we should focus on what happened or what Barack Obama did or did he do this or did he do that or who's to blame or Harry Reid is a jerk or whatever the case may be. Let's forget that. We should be looking out the front window talking about what's possible. That's why I want to know from Elizabeth. What is it that Donald Trump could do that might get her to be at least willing to consider his election? And we're going to talk about that in the next hour as well. And a lot of it also is going to depend on whether or not we have an administration and a press office that's going to stand up to the media, which they feel, and I do too, has been unfair to Donald Trump. But also, Donald Trump, in my view, with his tweets and some of these other things, he himself has got to pull back a little bit, not totally back. We don't want, you know, he is who he is. But again, I think he's got to think twice about some of the things that he's been saying and doing as well. That's my pitch. When we come back in hour number two, we're going to look forward. First night of the Trump administration here on Beyond the Beltway. We want to get your reaction. In fact, we've got somebody standing on the line right now. We'll bring him in from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. He wants to look way ahead. And we'll be back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away. The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from. or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head to the highways and byways of America. Al is listening to us on Sirius XM Radio, driving through the great state of Ohio tonight. Al, how can we help you?
Well, hey, I just wanted to let you know that if Donald Trump would have met with these women, I can tell you what they would have said to him, because I was on the train with them for hours and walking with them. I was there with my wife. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the rundown real quick.
Go ahead.
He, you know, they're concerned about Russia and Putin, Trump not showing his taxes. They don't want anybody on their reproductive rights. They want hands off. They see him as a misogynist. They voted for Bernie Sanders, many of them, not just for Hillary. They consider him a fascist in many cases, the way he's politicking. They see his behavior as treasonous. You know, they see him as somebody who's not really looking out for Americans. They also want him to apologize to all the people he's offended in his campaign. They don't see him as just, you know, passing into the presidency and then just, okay, you know, going on and being their commander-in-chief. They think he's got to have a come-to-Jesus with them because they're not happy with him. And they all went back home, and they're talking to other people. And
well, the issue is that probably would have not – that probably would not have been a very productive meeting, although I think the idea – of a meeting would have been a good idea. But again, if that was the tone of what they wanted to talk about, that's not likely to change him because you're
well, I don't think that they were trying to change him.
No.
They're getting empowered. I think what's happening is women are, they're looking at Congress and they're saying, you know, unless Congress is 50% women, you don't understand us. You don't really understand what our needs are. You don't get pregnant. You don't know what we have to go through raising kids and so forth. You know, they don't see Congress as a solution because they feel Congress is really kind of turned away.
Well,
from
the question is going to be now, which is the question I asked at the beginning of the show. They've got to organize. Anyway, Al, take a breath. Take a breath. Pull over. We're going to go to Tom in Youngstown, Ohio. I hope he slows down for the toll booth.
Yeah.
Tom in Youngstown, Ohio, go ahead. Listening to us on WKBN.
Happy new 4 years to you, Junior.
Thank you.
With respect to Trump and the situation he's facing right now, I don't know how much of it he's going to be able to resolve, because quite frankly, I think there's a cultural war between liberalism, socialism, and globalism on the one hand, and that was really, in my mind, what Hillary Clinton represented.
Mm-hmm.
And the opposite of that, conservatism and capitalism and nationalism, which Trump represented. And if you take a look at the very people that protested, in many instances, they fell into that first camp with Hillary Clinton. And I don't know how Trump can appease them without losing much of his base. The other thing I'd like to point out or ask your guest about, the criticism that Trump's getting in terms of wanting to reach out to Putin and try to work with him, how is that any different than what Roosevelt did with Stalin?
Right.
In terms of dealing with Hitler and the Axis powers, and right now we're facing ISIS and you know the whole Islamic fundamentalism,
mm-hmm.
Radical Islam situation, as well as China.
All right, let me start with you about the relationship between the United States and Russia. What's wrong with having a stronger relationship between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump?
I have no problem with the United States having strong, positive relationships with any nation, so long as those relationships further the interests of the United States. And I think that it's sort of an improper comparison to look at Roosevelt and Stalin versus Trump and Putin. You know, with Roosevelt and Stalin, it was the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And as soon as the Second World War was over, we made it very clear where we stood in relationship to Russia. I have concerns, have huge concerns about Putin's record on human rights. I certainly don't think that he should be helping to set policy for the United States domestically. At this point,
well, no one is suggesting that he's going to do that.
But I'm saying that we don't know what his intent is.
If Donald Trump's intent is to say, here's a guy who I think I can work with, who I think I can get Russia to focus more on the common enemy we have, ISIS,
right.
Just like Joe Stalin and FDR, they got together. The Nazis were worse than the communists at that point. Isn't this exactly what he's trying to do now?
So,
well, Brian, where do you, I want to get everybody's reaction to this.
Yeah, I actually am glad that he wants to work with Putin, but I find it fascinating. If you look at his team, mm-hmm. Tillerson, Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, if a Marine general gets called Mad Dog and he's not a sergeant, that dude's bad, all right? And so what I would argue is that if you look at that team, they're and when you say America first,
right.
Everybody look out. The world needs to look out. We have the most dominant country in the world, and we've, because of the globalist tendencies of a lot of politicians, we've wanted to be subservient to a lot of other countries. And China thinks China first,
mm-hmm.
But we go, okay, you can think of you first, and we'll help you. Get. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is, no, you want to compete with us? Compete with us on even footing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited about that. And at the same time, we can be friends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, IBM and Oracle and Microsoft, they don't hate each other, but they compete like cats and dogs on the mm-hmm. battlefield of capitalism. And I think that's what countries should do, too.
Mara, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that when the initial conversations were happening about the relationship between Trump and Putin, to me, the concern was just really treading carefully, because Putin is not a novice. He is expert at what he does. He understands the issues probably perfectly, more so than Trump and more so perhaps than anyone in the administration. So it's just the concern that when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to these relationships, to not just treat them as, well, I know them in the business sense, so all of that will translate automatically into foreign policy and even U.S. domestic policy, but to tread very, very carefully. And that was my big concern with Trump.
Yeah, Amara, I'm going to agree with you on that. Putin is unbelievably good. However, we have this tendency, I think, I don't know whether it's just because they're over there, they're so far away, to make them out to be like geniuses. But mm-hmm. but humans are humans everywhere. They have fears and they have dreams and hopes, and they think they can cow other people. And when you have somebody like Tillerson, who has run the biggest company in the world and negotiated with these people, Mattis, who has stood toe-to-toe with scarier people than Putin, I'm not so worried about Donald Trump's lack of international experience, because he's got a great team around him.
Well, he also has an acute awareness of Putin's Achilles heel, which is is their crumbling economy. It's in a real mess. And so, you know, Trump has assembled a team that's well aware of this and understands, I think, how to negotiate and how to work with someone like Putin. And I find it amazing that people now are articulating this fear that Trump is going to be led around the table by Putin when Trump has said over and over and over, America first. In fact, it was his address was replete with this kind of rhetoric during his inaugural. I'm talking about we will work with the nations of the world, but we do so with the understanding that it is the right of all nations to put their own interests first. And what happens is the media goes nuts and says, oh, it was dark. It was militant. We haven't heard this kind of nationalism, xenophobia, where what I'm hearing in this table is saying we want America first and we don't want Putin to be calling the shots. And Trump is not going to let Putin call the shots. He is in control. His team's in control. And that's the image that he's projecting across the world stage right now.
Let's hope so. 1-800-723-8029. More calls when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school. Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Rosanna, listening to us on WMAY in Springfield, Illinois. Go ahead, Rosanna.
Hi, Bruce. I think you mentioned something very important, the level of respect. And so I heard the ladies talk about the women who need help with childcare. And I believe there may be a lot of them who would like to join with the Women's March. But the level of respect that I saw, for instance, at the L.A. with Ashley Judd and Madonna, which shut a lot of those women off. So was this about women and their rights and their needs, or was it about these celebrities getting up and just being their kind of arrogant selves? If they're goal is to help women, I believe a lot of the women who may have been helped will not even join the group because of the disgusting behavior of women wearing vaginas on their head, the display of disrespect. And I would just like the ladies there to speak to that.
Elizabeth, we'll let you start.
Well, I do agree with you on some level. I feel that some of the visuals from the march, they're very exciting for some of the participants, but I do think we have to consider people who aren't with us, why, and if we are doing things that create barriers for a more inclusive group. The problem with having celebrities is that you can't give them talking points. I have tried in my professional life, and they say what they're going to say, and you just sit there and smile because your options are very limited. Certainly, I do not believe that the White House should be burned down. I believe the British tried that around 1812, and thankfully we had a First Lady who was on the job. But more seriously, I think that the challenge going forward is going to be to create a movement based on this that brings in more people, that deepens the bonds between people who were there. Amara said something that I think we need to unpack a little bit, to use your phrase, about the issue of the white women in who perhaps were new to marching versus the women of color who have been there fighting for many years. And I think that we need to find a swift way to bring those groups together, because getting back to the point of voter suppression, if we get 1% of the women who were marching to actually work, say, you know, to these white women with their minivans and their paid time off and their Hilton honors points, and they all get in those minivans and they go to North Carolina and they help people to get the ID that they will need to vote and get them registered, and then go back in October and November of 18 and 20 and make sure that those folks get to the polls, we will be able to change this nation. And the most crucial thing that we have to do is find a way to bring people together, to get make sure that Amara and I are on the same page, to the caller's point, to make sure that women who don't like the visuals feel that their concerns are being addressed. If we can do that, we can change the country.
But how likely is it that you're going to say, first of all, the people that wear outrageous or evocative or erotic costumes, whether it's at a gay rights parade or whether it's in Los Angeles yesterday, they're always going to be on TV.
Well, part of the challenge with I think a lot of the rallies took on the characteristics of where they were located. So Los Angeles with celebrities, it's going to have that celebrity feel to it, and I completely agree. It's hard to control what they say or how they say it. I think this brings up just.
But I don't hear you denouncing it. Mm-hmm. I don't hear you denouncing
it. I believe that I just did.
So I think so. Complete my point, that this brings up the fact that the challenge of bringing women together who aren't always on the same page. I have actually had conversations between yesterday and today from many women who were offended, who don't feel that this speaks to them because they're not going to put on pink hats, or they don't like the focus on genitalia, or because that's not their brand of feminism. And that's something that I don't think we talk enough about what does feminism look like. And the other thing is the fact that this, for so many, was sort of a new thing. It's a gotcha thing. So it's cute to put the signs on and put the hats on because you're in the energy of the moment. But again, there are women who have been doing the work of advocacy who are not on camera, who don't get airtime, who are in the trenches doing the work, and they're committed to the cause, not because they want to be on TV with a right. funny hat or a
That's
sign.
That's right. And I was frankly offended when, with Gloria Steinem. Here's the queen of the movement. She's saying yesterday that, if Muslims have to register, all women should register as Muslims. Mm-hmm. She's bringing in the Muslim issue, the immigration issue, which, in my view, I don't think is listed in the top five things
right.
that most women are talking
and
about.
And the irony of irony is...
It's this big pool of sort of left-leaning right. issues that everybody's got to be pulled into it
right.
when many women out there who are legitimately concerned about maternity leave and the things you talked about and equality of pay... They don't consider themselves liberal or progressive. They want to be treated fairly.
Right.
But
some of the wackos get out there and you want to burn down the White House, or you're talking about you're gonna muck up any immigration plan because somehow you don't think that Muslims should be registered.
Something
if you don't think that's
assuage,
a different issue, different rally.
Something that would assuage some of those concerns about just the sort of gotcha component of the rallies is that once the rallies are done, how many of those women will continue to be in the trenches doing the work? A lot of concerns from those of us who are doing the work we're not attracted because this is something that it's a feel-good moment and we're just excited because we're in this moment. So what happens after the march, after the energy has died down? How many of those women who were there, who had the signs, will come out for the other issues that were represented there when the cameras are off and when the lights are off?
Well, and I think you brought up something interesting, Bruce, about the Muslim issue as well. And it was cited quite a bit in the coverage that I saw with women marching, saying we're speaking up for our Muslim sisters. One of the head organizers' name was Linda Sarsour, who is a pro-Sharia law woman, an organizer with ties to Hamas. She's worked with Barack Obama as one of his advisors in the last 4 years. But what we don't, it's like the big elephant in the room. I heard a lot about Christian patriarchy and how evil that was, but yet a pro-Sharia law person, and Sharia law, one of the provisions is you have to have two men attest that a woman was raped or else they're going to throw her case out of court. You know, I'm not here to quibble against the tenets of Islam, but I find it amazing that that Islam generally is not viewed as something in favor of women's rights, but yet we have women standing up and saying, or the spokespeople for this movement, standing up and saying, we stand with our Muslim sisters, down with Christian patriarchy. And I'm sitting there scratching my head and saying, what is not making sense here? So it's an odd conglomeration of movements.
Hillary Clinton was not speaking out against that.
Right. I find it very strange, this group that's come together from all different sectors, and none of it really seems to congeal very well.
I also think, though, that they came together because they don't – a lot of women participated to just find a way for them to fit in. So their issue might have just been immigration, or it might have just been – they just found what their particular issue was so that they could be a part of the larger group.
Well, also, I mean, what I hear, too, though, from, like, Elizabeth, is what you said, is that the answer is politics. We need more people to vote for our people than we win. My brothers build homes in Missouri. All right, no women in minivans are running down from North Carolina to get them to the job site and to make sure they're fed at lunch. Mm-hmm. They're building houses, and they're fed up with people trying to say, we're going to put a government in that taxes you, your profits from building homes, to give somebody else that you don't know health care or daycare. And that's why they voted for Donald Trump. And I think this is what a lot of people don't understand, is that when you use the power of government to take from one group to give to another, because that's what it all is, that you end up with a lot of people that are not happy.
And so
the answer that you're giving is we just need more power in politics so that we can put even more of a grip on these producers and take more from them. It's just going to make more people mad in the long run.
The critique that I have for that is just because of what happens in Chicago, where we do have take public taxpayer dollars and give that to corporations. We do it all the time in the form of incentives. We have a priorities issue.
I'm totally against that.
So I feel like that's the critique that I have for that, because we see it all the time and it doesn't work. And then you have poor leadership that does not prioritize appropriately and doesn't make the necessary economic investments that could really maximize our economy here. But then we still take public tax dollars and give them away to corporations.
And Amara, you are absolutely right about that. And we have about a $600 billion deficit in the U.S. right now. If you got rid of all the corporate welfare, it would still be a $500 billion deficit. So in other words, we're on our way, by the way, to never having a surplus again unless we fix it. This is a crucial time economically. Chicago's past the time. We are now to the point where the only way to fix our budget deficit, if you raise taxes anymore, you're going to chase people away. Then property values go down, and this great city will get killed, just like
it's
Detroit.
Yeah.
So in the nation as a whole, I'm not predicting gloom and doom, and it's, you know, I'm not. We're still growing, but and we did under President Obama. But we are getting to that point if we don't get a control of our spending, and that's taking care of everybody's daycare and health care and education. If we don't get control of it, it will bankrupt us.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. Lots of callers on the line. Good conversation tonight. The first Sunday night beyond the Beltway of the Trump administration. Thanks for joining us.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and a question I have for you, Amara. When you have been on this program in the past, we've talked about the importance of improving the cities around the United States, not just Chicago, not only with crime, but with opportunities and businesses and a lot of other things. What is your opinion of Ben Carson being the designated secretary of HUD? And secondly, what do you think of the idea of engaging Steve Harvey to join and help the administration address these issues?
Well,
laughing is from the left side of the table tonight.
Well,
laugh or you cry.
Well, I mean,
Al Franken got in, by the way.
I've talked a lot about this issue with Steve Harvey with Ben Carson. So with regard to HUD and Ben Carson, I don't think it's a great fit. He doesn't have the requisite background or experience in anything related to housing or urban development. And this is a pretty important department. Right. And so I just question the whether it's wise to have Ben Carson in that position. Also, from a management perspective, I mean, Ben Carson is a world-renowned neurosurgeon, so you cannot argue about his expertise in the field of medicine. But from a management perspective and managing a large bureaucracy such as HUD that has such an integral role in cities and the disbursement of funds to cities related to housing and development, I don't think that it was a good choice, but it's the choice that Trump made.
I want to hear our Republicans respond to this, mm-hmm. and then I want to come back to Steve Harvey.
Well, I would say that Leon Panetta had very, very little experience when he was put in the position he was in, and I think Ash Carter is another one. So, I mean, you know, I think sometimes people grow into their roles. I think a lot depends on their staff that they have with them.
Well, Panetta was a long-time member of Congress, though.
He was. He was a member of Congress. But, you know, there's no question that Ben Carson has an amazing intellect. He's got an amazing story, and he lived it. He lived his life in Detroit, in poverty. He knows of, you know, the experience. And I think that he works very well with people. He's worked with medical teams, vast medical teams, from everything from transplants. And that's a whole bureaucracy in itself.
I agree with everything you said about Ben Carson. I don't think it's a great pick. Mm-hmm. The fact that he lived in public housing, that's nice to know. But I don't think that to head the administration of HUD is a good. I don't think it's a right fit. There could have been another spot.
I think that's one of the reasons why it took him so long to say yes.
Yeah.
I heard him at least at one point publicly say, management, I'm paraphrasing, isn't my strong suit. The good, at least from what I understand about, and I worked in D.C. for a couple years, is that the secretary doesn't have to be the manager because they do have a deputy secretary, and that is where you can reach in and grab mm-hmm. a great manager from
You need a Jack Kemp Republican.
That's what
to
I
put into that position. Paul Ryan is a Jack Kemp Republican.
Yes.
You have to find a Republican that understands the whole HUD series,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think Ben Carson is
got a long history, and it's a very complicated agency.
No,
there's
I want
no
to come
doubt
back.
About it.
What
yeah.
about the idea of?
I just want to stand up for a second. I mean, if Trump wanted to focus some of his energies on the city of Chicago, housing policy is a great place to do it, and there's definitely a great opportunity for improvement, especially with the Emanuel administration. And I'm not sure that Ben Carson is going to be the person who will see that opportunity and capitalize on it in a way that benefits the people who need it.
Is the Emanuel administration going to be able to work with the Trump administration? And I say that literally for any Democrat. Given the way this country is split at the moment, are Democrats going to be able to work with Donald Trump and survive politically, or is the hatred and the angst and the gnashing of teeth so strong now that a Democrat would be fearful to help the President of the United States, even if it means helping the people who need it?
I don't think that he has a choice. As mayor of the city and in leadership, you're required to operate in the best interests of the city of Chicago. And that means working with people whom you may find unpalatable or for whom you may disagree. We have far too many issues on the table that Chicago is dealing with to jeopardize our lives and livelihoods because you want to act you want to act in the interest of political expediency and you're concerned about your reelection. I don't think that that's the right move for him to make.
You laughed when I mentioned Steve Harvey.
I did.
Okay. Why?
Because there's been so much conversation over the last week about the viability of Steve Harvey coming in and being able to, first, meeting with Trump to begin with. So that was an issue that was on the table. And second, to be able to address the issues, for example, in the city of Chicago. My take on it was that the thing that bothers me about it is the post-meeting press conference and circus, which to me seems wholly unnecessary. I think if Trump, who operates in those spaces, Steve Harvey has moderated or hosted an event, one of Trump's pageants or what have you. So maybe they have a personal relationship, and maybe the only way he can make room into urban issues is by calling on someone like Steve Harvey, which is fine. But I don't think that. I don't think that the post meeting press conference is necessary. I think it undermined the credibility of a Steve Harvey. I also don't know the amount of prep time before the meeting where he can actually engage with individuals who know what community development looks like, what economic development looks like in these urban centers, and the kinds of policies that he can bring to the table to recommend to Trump and his administration.
Talked about the same thing with Robert Johnson, the head of Black.
Johnson would be. No,
Johnson. Talk right. About that. And both of them were for Hillary Clinton.
Both of them
were for Hillary Clinton, and they want to help mm-hmm. because they want to provide the economic opportunities.
It's about the
to
substance.
Lift up the communities
it's
that
about
need
the
to be
substance
helped.
Afterwards. It's about business. It's about the substance after. I don't critique Steve Harvey or anyone for meeting with Donald Trump. My concern, if it were me, if he asked me to meet, I would say, sure, I'll meet with you. I don't want to do the post-meeting press conference. Can I consult with some of my colleagues who are experts and maybe bring some of them into the meeting, and we can have a productive conversation. We have the meeting, and then we move from there. If Trump is serious and concerned about the substance of the meetings, then I think he'd be okay foregoing the post-meeting press conference, and that shows his sincerity.
If Donald Trump asked you if you were interested in a role at HUD or the U.S. Department of Education, something that's near and dear to your heart, you care about what happens to the city of Chicago.
Yes.
You care about what happens to people who live on the southwest and northwest side, the south sides and west sides, people of color. You care about them.
Yes.
If you had an opportunity to do something as a member of the administration, would you say yes?
If Donald Trump asked or called upon me to assist, I would certainly take the meeting. I would request that I would not have to participate in any post-meeting. I don't need a circus. I don't need cameras.
You don't want to be used because of the color of your face.
I don't want to be, exactly, or for any other agenda. But I would certainly take that meeting. I would consult with my colleagues. We would have a strategic plan of action on the table when we walked into that meeting, and then we would take it from there. I think that's my responsibility as a public policy, someone who works in public policy, and as someone who cares about my city.
You are the second guest on Beyond the Beltway in the last month when I've asked that question. The other one was Patrick Cotter, who was the former assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, New York, the guy that got John Gotti, mm-hmm. who sat in your seat, Elizabeth, a few weeks ago and laid out the case, how he wants to take down gangs in Chicago and reduce crime in Chicago by using the same strike force mentality that Bobby Kennedy used to go after organized crime. He's a heavy player. And I asked him, I said, if the attorney general, the new attorney general called you, would you accept the job? And he said, in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. So we may be getting a couple of federal jobs out of this program.
I just want to follow up on something.
People who care about, uh-huh. people who are qualified for and really care about the issues of improving the life of poor people and people who are being killed and shot in the city of Chicago as well as other cities. They care about that.
There's another point. I want to follow up on something that Amara said. She said that Mayor Emanuel has a responsibility to the people he represents. So does Donald Trump. When he took that oath, he became my president. He became your president. And, you know, just as Rahm Emanuel cannot ignore Washington, President Trump cannot ignore the cities and the people who lived in them, whether or not they voted for him. When you take that oath, you are the president of the whole country, and you have a sworn responsibility.
I think he understands that.
Let us hope so.
But the women or the men who are out there, he's not my president, they don't believe that.
Right.
Well, you know, you can say that all you want to. It doesn't change reality.
I don't want this guy to help me. I don't want this guy to solve a problem. I will give him no credit for it. He's not my president.
Well, here's an analogy.
Why would anybody want to spend time talking to a
person?
They
will never change their minds.
Here's an analogy, though.
One of they is in the room.
An analogy is that the United States is like a plane. And right now, Donald Trump, President Trump, is the pilot. Now, we are all on the plane, whether we like it or not. The door is locked. We're in the air. So it is in all of our best interests to make sure that he is able to make and compelled to make the best decisions as pilot, that he is operating at full mental capacity, and that he has the best team around him on behalf of everyone that's on that plane.
I couldn't agree more. President Obama did not act like he was the president of all the people. I will tell you that.
No.
When he passed Obamacare without one single Republican vote, Harry Reid would not allow one single Republican amendment on the floor for Obamacare. That was not the president of all the people. And what Donald Trump is saying is that those decisions that were made, that were made with very one-sided, they're going to be changed. We're going to go back to ground zero, and then and what I hear a lot of his opposition saying is, oh, no, any ground we gained is ground we're never giving up. And if you make us give it up, then you're not our president.
Brian, Jennifer, Elizabeth, Amara, thanks very much for being with us. We will continue our conversation, but some of you have to leave us right now.
My name is Johnny Carson. My job is to make you laugh.
Johnny Carson brings you TV legends and classic moments every night on Antenna TV.
Don't make fun of me, Johnny.
And now through February, don't miss Here's Johnny, the making of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. It's a must-see collection of Johnny's stage props, costumes, video, and more. For more info and tickets, go to museum.tv.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Stability issue.
Mr. back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. One of the other issues that I want to talk with you about, Brian, and that is trade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and the president disagree on trade, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to win that battle. You or him?
Yeah, he's the president. You know, I found it fascinating. He wants to. He says he wants to tax any company that leaves 35%. I think he's modified that language a little bit, but you can't do that. That's unconstitutional. In fact, I heard Bill O'Reilly arguing with somebody, and Bill was playing the populist and going, "I'm with Trump. He needs to." And I tweeted to Bill O'Reilly that, "Hey, Bill, any president that can tax one company 35% can tax one TV anchor 35% as well. You can't do it. It's unconstitutional." And if he were to put a tariff on imports, it would harm our ability to grow. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, in my opinion, was one of the key causes of the Great Depression. Trade is an unambiguous good for the economy. And so here's how I would achieve his objectives, and that is we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. If you cut corporate taxes and you decrease regulation, and these are a lot of the reasons that corporations move overseas, you would woo companies to come back or woo them into staying, and you would actually attract more foreign investment, and you'd get your desired result without raising taxes, which is what a tariff really is, and without harming the competitive marketplace.
Mm-hmm. When will What has been the reaction of your clients? What has been the reaction to Trump's election, and when will you really get the first sense of how the business community is really responding to him?
Sure. Well, I live in the financial world, and for good or bad, a lot of the financial world tends to be more conservative. It believes more in free markets. And when I talk about that, I'm not talking about the social agenda at all, just taxes, right. Regulation, the size of government and its intrusion or non-intrusion into markets.
Right.
And so they're much more they're happy is not the right word, but more excited for the potential. If you go back and look at the 80s when Ronald Reagan was elected, it was a boon for financial markets. It was a boon for the economy. It was a boon for investment.
They like the cabinet?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would argue that one of the ways you can see this is forget about my customers and the people I work with, but look at the National Federation of Independent Businesses. These are all the small businesses across the country that joined this. Their confidence index jumped by the most in 1 month ever in its history back in December and January after the election. And I think that's what they're saying is that they have felt overregulated, overtaxed, and that they believe that Donald Trump is going to remove some of those burdens. It's based on hope and based on a belief, but their confidence index went through the roof.
I would like to parse out the business community, as in small businesses and corporations, from the financial sector. I think from a business standpoint, the notion of, and I'm thinking small businesses, especially locally here in Chicago, the notion of reducing regulations is always, I mean, it's a huge burden for a lot of the business owners. So I do think that there's some confidence or some optimism about that being part of what the Trump administration will usher in, fewer regulations on that, which a level of that I think is okay. I think my concern is in the financial sector, the reduction of regulations and what that means. So the 80s was actually the time when banks and large banks shifted from high-frequency trading became the thing, where banking just shifted in the nature of what it did. We've had unregulated financial institutions that essentially crash the economy. And so I think the push to regulate, especially in the financial sector, is because of the concern of what happens when it's not regulated closely enough and when financial institutions really took advantage of that fact and essentially crashed our economy.
I won't go on long about this, but Amara, back in 2007, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, government entities, owned 76% of all the subprime debt. Wall Street only owned 24%. I'm not saying they didn't get involved in that market, but we never would have had the subprime marketplace that we had if it weren't for governments. And speaking of HUD, what Ben Carson's going to take over is the one that made Fannie and Freddie buy all those underperforming loans, those bad loans. And so what the Wall Street feels like, what the financial markets feel like, is that they've been blamed wrongly for the crisis, right. And they've been overregulated. And, in fact, we have crushed the financial sector. We have fewer IPOs in the U.S., initial public offerings, companies going public, just in case anybody doesn't know, than we have in a very, very long time. And it's because of this burden of regulation and compliance that has been pushed down. And the financial sector feels like the economy could do better if it weren't so overburdened. So it's not Wall Street's fault that we had the crisis. It literally goes back to HUD and a lot of what government did.
I want to come back to something we discussed at the beginning of the show because it's likely to be the big news tomorrow because Sean Spicer is having his first official press briefing. Do you expect him to get raked over the coals pretty severely tomorrow? And should Sean Spicer, should he act differently tomorrow than he did when he addressed the press yesterday?
I think Sean Spicer needs to be very careful that he's got his facts verifiable if he's going to state something like that. I do think that Sean Spicer is going to get raked over the coals, and I think he's going to do his own raking. I think it's going to be a mutual raking. I do want to point out that in the press conference that he had yesterday, what preceded that, and everyone here, we were talking about that, was the comment by reported by Time magazine that Trump was going to have the Martin Luther King bust removed from the Oval Office, which was a lie. And Sean Spicer was addressing that right before this whole brouhaha over the numbers not being correct for the inauguration. And so you are going to lie. You're going to get called on it repeatedly. And just like Reince Priebus came out and said, we are going to take the press to task every day and twice on Sunday. And that's what we're going to be seeing from here on out. I just want Sean Spicer to be a little more savvy when he does it.
And also, frankly, when you got the media in a gotcha moment, which right. the MLK removal of the bus yes. was all about, when you got them in a gotcha moment, don't throw some ammunition that they
right.
can throw back on you.
I agree.
Hey, just stop
agree.
There and forget about the photos and all this you right. know, crowd envy that went on. He would have been much better off. Anyway, that's our advice. Thank you for joining us tonight. Our thanks to Chris Zwick. And also to Dan Dorfman and Fritz Goldman for their assistance in the production of this program. Bruce Dumont, good night from Chicago. The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while 1 in 5 children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, 3 more fingers for everyone over 60, 2 over 50, 1 over 40, 1 more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, 2 if you're very overweight, and 3 if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up 5 or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.